Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Okay, so Gio, I've got my sword here in the sheath, and I got to be a bit careful not to cut the ceiling. But
okay, because it is a real sword, right?
Yeah, it's not sharpened, but it's balanced and shaped like a real sword. And if you well, here, I'll just give it. See if you just, you know, pick up your ears and see if you can catch the sound.
Yeah. Wow.
That's
okay.
Air.
Yeah. That's fast.
And you can't do that with a wooden sword. It's too thick.
Okay. That's cool. I love that you can you can hear that sound. I'm sure. I'm sure that's a scary thing to hear coming by your face or dodging, huh?
Well, I don't think you'd have, if it actually struck you, I don't think you'd get a chance to hear it, but
yeah, I'm saying if you're dodging it, and you know, they say that bullets crack as they come by your head or something like that, and that, you know, a sword whips.
Exactly. Yeah, it is like a whip. It's kind of soft, and the motion is like fly fishing, you know, it's got to be out there.
Yeah, and it kind of accelerates toward the end of the strike, and that's part of what the crack of a whip does, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. Thanks for joining us today. I'm your host Giovanni Gallo, and I am pleased to present William Reed. He is a Renaissance samurai. So stick with us. We're going to talk about samurai, and then we're going to talk about how this can improve your workplace, your culture, and your ethics and integrity program. Will Reed is a Renaissance samurai. He applies wisdom and disciplines of samurai culture to our modern day culture. So it's going to be a really interesting discussion. I think there's a lot that we can learn from the samurai who had a very intentional ethic that drove their culture and their behavior. And Will has studied a lot, and he's going to share some of that with us today. Will, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Gio. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here. So we always like to tell personal stories on this. You know, we talk about how people found their career and how they found their passion for culture and ethics and things like that. So tell us a little bit about that, Will, how you came to, you know, you don't have to talk about how you came on the podcast, but how you came to be a guy who studies samurai culture, sitting sitting with your calligraphy behind you and demonstrating a samurai sword before we got on here.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll go back a little bit. I'll try to keep it brief, but it actually goes back to 1963 when I was walking home from school with a friend, and suddenly we found ourselves surrounded by these older boys from junior high school and high school, and they kind of roughed us up. You know, and it was a typical bullying situation. We didn't even know who they were, you know, or what their big deal was, but they scared us. And they, so I could say my initial motivation was fear, you know, because I realized there was nothing I could do to defend myself and how unfair it was, but they're going to be there waiting for us, right? Again.
Yeah.
So I that led me to a book called The Power of Aikido, and didn't have any teacher or dojo to train at, but I did have two younger brothers, and so I kind of experimented on them and developed a taste for it. And this led me in college to, or in high school, to an interest in Japan, and then rediscovering that book, and eventually led me to come to Japan in 1972 as an exchange student. And that's when I started Aikido, and of course Aikido is very much connected to samurai culture, and that was 48 years ago.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that's great. It's great that you took that adversity, that, you know, that fear and that unfairness, and built that into something that is really, you know, I think, from what I've seen and from what we've talked about, giving you personal strength, a lifelong interest, and also a way to help other people.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about martial arts is that a lot of people start the martial arts for reasons similar to that, wanting to learn self-defense. And yet the chances of, the odds of you getting attacked are really pretty small. And so a lot of the things you practice, you don't really get to or even want to use. but it does change the way you carry yourself, and it develops your sense for respectful distance. I mean, people talk about social distancing. Well, Summer, I've been doing that for centuries.
They had it figured out, didn't they?
Most of those guys, right? but a culture based on respect, and that includes self-respect and respect for people's distances and people's space, even recognition that space is a real thing. And so that actually reduces the bullying, because just the way you carry yourself. So that's one interesting thing that happens as a result of that kind of training.
Cool. It's a great thing how you can be driven by driven away from something, or driven by that fear, and find strength in the result. Talk to me a little bit about, let's give the audience kind of an overview of the samurai or the Bushido ethic. I'd love to talk a little bit about how you teach on that and kind of what your reflections are, as we dig into that.
Sure. Well, the samurai history goes back to, say, the 1100s, and lasts until about 1867, when they were formally banished. And then I've got a book in my hand here called Training the Samurai Mind, a Bushido source book. And it quotes, obviously in English translations, over the periods of time, all the different interpretations of what the samurai mind should be about. And so a lot of it is based on something called Neo-Confucianism. And so they took the concepts of Confucianism, but there was a guy who started sort of Neo-Confucianism in China, Wang Yangming, became sort of the leading inspiration for samurai ethics. So the samurai were actually inspired by a lot of spiritual traditions. They had Zen, which kind of taught them how to live in the moment and how to face death and be fully present. And then they had Shinto, which is the native religion of Japan, which was more about purifying their spirit and kind of getting self-renewal. And they had Neo-Confucianism, which was really about ethics. And they also had Christianity, although not for all of them and not for all periods of Japan, but there were a lot of Christian samurai.
So they were all, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and then, they would look over time, they would come up with new interpretations of, what it meant to be a samurai. And actually the word Bushido, which it was made famous by Nitobe Inazo in a book written a little over 100 years ago, well after the samurai were gone. And even like the word ninja, that wasn't used during the Edo period, when you actually had a lot of ninja. They called them different names. And this was actually, the word ninja was introduced by novelists, and Nitobe Inazo was the one who came up, who codified the word Bushido, and actually, created what we call the Bushido Code. And there are, according to some, 7, and according to some, 8 different elements of this Bushido Code. And what it includes, just briefly, is, I'll just read the words out: justice, courage, compassion, respect, integrity, honor, loyalty, and self-control.
To argue with any of those, Will. Those all seem like good ethics to have.
Well, see, Nitobe Inazo was a Christian, actually, and he wrote this book in English first. He was, I think he was a member of the League of Nations, around World War I, and this book was written to kind of introduce Japanese culture, to bring it to the level of respect on the Western, among Western powers, and comparing it to chivalry, and saying that they actually had a code of ethics. And of course this was somewhat compiled from as I said, that depends on the era that of the samurai as to how they would interpret it. But it's interesting because it's very difficult to define, but it's easy to recognize. That's samurai. Well, what do you mean? Well, I'm not sure, but it's just, there's something quintessential about it. But the interesting thing about this book by Nitobe Inazo Bushido is that it not only became one of the core conceptual frameworks for the Boy Scouts, the Boy Scout Oath, a lot of similarity there, you know, I'll be loyal, brave, trustworthy, you know, and then the merit badges, the round merit badges that you get for learning how to build a campfire or tie knots, those were modeled after the round family crests of the samurai. And the idea of discipline building up to a certain level. I mean, Baden Powell was the guy who founded the Boy Scouts, but he was influenced by the samurai thinking in that. And there were two U.S. presidents who also were very much influenced by this book. One was Theodore Roosevelt, and the other one was John F. Kennedy. So the book has actually been around a while, even in English.
That's really interesting. So from what you know, Will, I'd love to get some of your perspective. You know, I want to dig into that code a little bit, but a lot of what we talk about as ethics experts is how to build and foster and encourage a culture, an ethical culture, a culture of integrity, a culture where within a workplace, people behave in a way that, you know, is honorable and that we can all hold our heads high on. Talk to us a little bit about how the samurai, you know, built these values into their culture, how they taught them, how they, you know, maybe managed and monitored and, you know, reinforced or celebrated them.
Great question, Gio. Actually, why don't we start with, I gave you eight elements of the code. Why don't we start with the word integrity? And I actually have it on a piece of calligraphy. Bring it up here so you can see it. But this is the word for it means integrity. And the interesting thing about the etymology of this character is on the left-hand radical means speech, and the right-hand radical means to become. So in other words, words become deeds. Or words should be consistent with deeds.
So yeah, they're integrated.
If you're integrated, if you have integrity, if you have authenticity, you walk your talk. You don't say one thing and do something else. And so this was one of the sort of code words of the Bushido ethic.
And what is that word? What is that word when spoken?
Makoto is how it's pronounced in Japanese. Makoto. And it means integrity,
Cool. So that was kind of at the core of the consistency around their whole ethical code.
Well, it for example, and this is again one of seven or eight, depending on who you talk to. But for example, to live up to your greatest potential. In other words, you set your standards high and you speak about them in a public way. So you pledge, you make a pledge.
Okay.
And then it's a pledge also to yourself that you will then be consistent in behavior. It's like holding yourself to a higher standard. And obviously not lying. You know, there would be different elements to that. But the idea that you had to hold your, and obviously, you know, samurai are humans, right? So not every one of them is going to be a paragon of virtue. There were some pretty nasty samurai, and you have the same kind of power struggles, and sometimes actually some of the dramas that come out in samurai history were based on rectifying the wrongs. And a great wreck of life, you know, and the incredible bravery and some of them just they would seem like revenge tales, but under considering the circumstances that they were under. It's pretty amazing what they did. The story of the 47 Ronin, that's quite famous, you know, the 47 loyal vassals. And that story, just in a nutshell, the Japanese daimyo or lords had to visit Edo, which is now contemporary Tokyo, and they had to spend a lot of money and they had to bring their retainers and leave their families there as hostages. And there was a whole system set up for controlling them. Right. And and there was a kind of a hierarchy of who was considered loyal and who was a lesser samurai. And then the story goes, this is a true story, that one, the person in charge of ethics who was supposed to teach the various visiting samurai how to behave in the castle in front of the shogun, and really detailed etiquette and, you know, what kind of gifts you had to give and when you bow and how deep and everything. And he deliberately did not teach this one guy from the what is now the Hiroshima prefecture. And he was trying to humiliate him, and he was doing a pretty good job. And the guy lost his temper, drew his sword on him in the castle. And of course, that was a crime punishable by death, but they didn't even give him a trial. I mean, that same afternoon, he had to commit seppuku ritual suicide, and they banished they took away all the possessions of his family and the castle. They were all turned out as masterless samurai. And, you know, that's a pretty devastating thing to have happen to your whole house, right?
Yeah, and, your whole lineage.
But 47 of them actually decided that they would gain vengeance. And of course, that would have been an illegal act. And so they were under constant monitoring, and they had to pull off this ruse. And the leader of them, Oishi Kuranosuke, was an amazing samurai who had studied Bushido ethics, the Neo-Confucianism, and Zen. And so he had all of this plus sword training behind him, but he was able to put on this ruse as if they were just going to, you know, forget about it and just squander their energy and their resources in the houses of pleasure in Kyoto and everything. But all the while they were planning this vengeance tale, and they pulled it off, and they didn't know what to do with them because they had upheld the loyalty code and gained vengeance on their lord, which was very samurai-like. But at the same time, they had broken the law. And so what do you do with them? And they eventually, took them about a year to decide, but eventually they decided they had to commit seppuku as well. And so you can go visit their gravesite, and you can see the actual uniforms that they wore that night and the place where it happened. And it's pretty, and it's been the subject of many movies as well. You could say, well, it's just a vengeance tale, but there was a lot of what was right, what was considered fair and right, and what was considered justice. And so,
yeah, there are a lot of sides to that, which we deal with, I think, frequently when we kind of get into the nuance of, you know, running an ethics program, where it's not always cut and dry. It's not always, are you being good or are you being bad? But, you know, people have loyalty to their family and loyalty to their job and loyalty to their code of ethics. And sometimes those are in conflict. I think in the story that you brought up, it shows that, you know, there was something that was legal. That legal power was maybe being wielded unjustly. There was something that seemed right to do, but it came at a cost of kind of the ethic and the code. And, you know, the characters in the story, the 47 run-in, had you know, they had a tough choice to make, but they had this core of, even if this scenario is not defined in our code of ethics, we know, you know, like you were saying earlier, you know, it just feels like samurai code. They said it feels like this is right, even if the person above me is saying to do something that is different. My code of ethics defines what the right thing to do is.
Yeah, well, you know, you get into the issue of authenticity, right? So you have your own code of what you believe is right. And if you are working for an employer who's asking you to do things that go against that, that's quite a challenge, you know. Are you willing to, well, as they say, sell your soul, right?
Yeah.
Or are you willing to I mean, we all participate in society that is not perfect. And so there's going to be some level of compromise, I suppose, even when you buy products that are not necessarily good for the environment.
Yeah.
But we, you know, when it cuts to your core values, that's when you really have to be clear. And what I think, Gio, is pretty exciting now is that companies are starting to, I think, with more transparency now, you can't get away from things that easily, right? Because somebody's going to call you on it, or there's going to be a video, or there's some kind of accountability. And then what is it, the Business Roundtable coming out with the purpose of the corporation? It's not, as Milton said, just to make a profit, but you need to also not just take care of stakeholders, but but also the employees and the customers and the environment and the suppliers, that you've got to look after all of them.
Mm.
And that's really a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really part of samurai culture, actually, back hundreds of years ago. They talked about being, how can I say, authentic or being helpful in four dimensions. And four dimensions were, this is really more about merchants than samurai, but it has to be good for you, yourself, you know, for your company and for your customer and for society. And here's the thing I find interesting, for previous and future generations.
Mm.
The time axis comes into that.
Mm-hmm.
And they even today, Japanese will act as if their ancestors are even physically present, or they will acknowledge that they are somehow being held accountable to them. They will take a part of their meal and place it on an altar to share it with the ancestors. And so there is this sense that you need to be, it's not just about what you can get away with or what's just happening this quarter. It has to be a longer span of time.
Yeah, it really does. And I think that that's an aspect that we as ethics experts are really leading the charge on. Listen, if we work for a board of directors or a CEO who already gets this, then we're happy that, you know, we're all heading in the same direction. But I think the ethics profession as a whole is helping not only helping the companies that get this move toward it, but also helping leaders and companies realize that this full stakeholder view, this approach of let's do the right thing, even if we're not being forced to by a regulator, it's good business, it's good for people, it's good for our culture and our community, and you know, it's good for the world, including, you know, honor the people who came before us and take care of the people who come after us.
Yeah, well spoken. And what do you think, Gio, the idea that ethics, my feeling is that it isn't just a matter of making rules and policing policies and enforcing that, but just getting people to think about it. Because if there is truth in the principles, it should be something that we can all kind of agree upon or arrive at after a certain amount of reflection or maybe some experience, but not just do because, you know, you're going to get punished if you don't, or somebody's watching. Because if that's your motivation, then what are you going to do when nobody's watching?
Exactly.
You're not going to do it, right?
Exactly.
There's a great phrase in Japanese that says "Otento-sama," which means the sun. And so they would often tell kids, "Otento-sama is watching." So the sun is watching. And I remember when I first learned that, I asked my teacher, my Japanese language teacher, said, does that mean you can do whatever you want on a cloudy day? But you know, that's the idea that somebody is watching, and this is reflected in so many aspects of the culture. For example, Japanese companies are often accused of over specs, and that of course raises the price. So why would you polish and have really high spec, appearance on an area that nobody's ever going to see? It's something inside. And this goes way back to the 700s when there'd be a Buddha statue that nobody would ever see the back, and it's perfect. Is in any direction, whatever you look at, it's going to be super high craftsmanship. I used to work in the automotive business, and there was a guy from the States who was trying to sell tires to one of the major auto parts retailers. And so he came, and they had a better price than they were getting in Japan. So he thought he was going to get the business. And they supplied some samples. They said, I'm sorry, we can't accept these. There was nothing wrong with them. But there was a little bit of bead on the inside that was like that nobody's ever going to see. But the company that was going to buy the tires said, yeah, our customers don't buy a product number. They buy a specific tire. So they will actually run their fingers on the inside of it. And even though there's no effect on the function, to them, the idea that you would be sloppy in some area would maybe reflect on other quality problems, and they just wanted to be perfect, you know. So he kind of had to swallow his pride and persuade the people back home. He actually ended up getting a very large order of tires, But the other thing that was really cool is I think they got some, they passed a number of ESO, high level quality QC, specs, because being careful about all those details that even didn't seem to matter made them careful about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard wise people say that the way you do one thing is the way you do everything.
Yeah. That's a great phrase.
Yeah. So I think that becomes, it can become the opposite of that can be an insidious part of our culture when we say, oh, only when the regulators are looking, are we going to make sure we're doing this right? Or only on the things that are audited and that we have a policy about, are we going to act ethically? And to your point, Will, when you're just relying on policy and policing and only doing what is enforced, then, you at best only get compliance with those things. I think what you actually do is you only get compliance on those things when you're enforcing it. And I think that when we can drive a culture, a strong culture that is driven around values, that gets people, to your point, Will, thinking about these things so that we don't have to define, hey, if you get this type of request on a Wednesday afternoon and it's cloudy, then you should make sure that you do, that you adjust it this way. But we can equip people with an ethic. We can build a culture that has integrity where what you say is tied to the actions. And it extends beyond the enforcement and the policy and the regulations to actually doing things right.
Yeah. Well, I actually had an experience just recently. I teach at a college, in Japan.
Yeah.
Near Mount Fuji. And they had, I guess the data department decided that we needed to, sign off on our commitment towards data protection. So it was a compliance endeavor. And we had to go online and take a test, and it was all case studies. It was all like, well, this person was careless and they left the USB in the printer and they came back the next morning and it was gone. And then this had consequences, right? Or they took their computer with them to a restaurant and they left it in and somebody swiped it. And so what happens, just thinking about showing how things go can go wrong, and just making you think about that, as opposed to saying you cannot do this, you should not do this. So it was kind of interesting to see that approach.
Yeah, and I think the best versions of those trainings help you extend that to, okay, well, what is going on? What is your risk that's like this, right? Because it can't just be a memorization of, okay, well, there's the printer thing and the restaurant thing, and then I just worry about that. But you start thinking about it and you start saying, okay, well, I'm maybe not going to a printer, but I'm on a manufacturing floor, or, I don't have a laptop, but I have a phone, and extend that. And I think that's the strength of, more a code of ethics than a set of policies that says, here are the things that you should watch out for.
That's interesting. I don't know if you'd call this ethics or compliance, but management training. And I mentioned the names of the companies, but I was doing some coaching for a person, a fairly major retailer here, household word, and they had like 65 different behavioral standards that they had to comply with. And they had the earphones on while they're serving the customers, and a lot of it was about, if you will, compliance about the behavior. And it was like, how do you remember all those things? But if you really just think about the spirit behind them, it's a lot of it's common sense, and it's just customer oriented and doing the right thing. But somebody made it a rule, 65 rules, and they're being monitored all the time. I said, that's terrible.
It almost makes you wonder why they stopped at 65. Couldn't they think of three or four more?
Well, it's you can be sure they'll add to the list, right?
Sure. Yeah. As soon as they find something that someone didn't do, they say, all right, we got 66 now.
Yeah. Exactly.
Go ahead, please.
If I could get back to martial arts for a second, back in the 70s, you remember the movie Kung Fu, which became a 3-year running television program with David Carradine. I thought that was a really interesting show. That was exactly around the time that when it started, actually, is when I went to Japan. I came back and there was the show, right? And because and I actually saw a documentary about it later where some elementary school teacher, sixth graders, sent a letter to the producers saying, "Thank you for showing my students that you don't need a gun to be a man." You know, that was so cool, you know, and because he was always unarmed, and he wouldn't injure that the people, he saved people, and there was always kind of an ethical thing. Oh, another favorite, which is actually earlier than that, was "Have Gun, Will Travel," Richard Burton. Did you ever see any of those?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't watched it.
Yeah, well, there's a lot on YouTube. It's really fun to watch. But he, those were actually written by Gene Roddenberry, who went on to write Star Trek. You know, so there's a philosophy in it, and here you have this cowboy. He's a gunfighter, and he lives in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and has this luxury lifestyle until he gets a request to go out to New Mexico or Arizona, some desert where somebody's in trouble, and he goes and saves them. That's always the same story, but they had leading ladies and leading men playing across him. It was quite an interesting show, but he was a Renaissance cowboy. I mean, I call myself a Renaissance samurai.
Okay.
But I really admired what he did, because he spoke Chinese and he spoke Apache, and he was multilingual, right? And he would quote Shakespeare sometimes. But he was also had his Smith and Wesson, you know, he was fastest gun around. You know, so there is a gunfighter who is also a philosopher and a good person, basically, who writes the wrong.
Yeah, fighting for what's right.
Yeah. And they don't make movies like that anymore. In fact, I don't even think they make Westerns anymore. You know, after Dances with Wolves, I think that was about the last one they did. But they keep making samurai movies, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. There's some draw to that, the strength of that code, of that culture that says, you know, we're going to stay faithful to this even at the expense of my physical safety.
Well, and Gio, there's another thing is that these things would not be taught by, I mean, they would have rules and they would have precepts, but it wasn't a matter of just memorizing the rules. They would actually train them through physical motions. I went to Okinawa for NHK is like the BBC of Japan, and we did a documentary on the roots of karate there. And it was very interesting because one of the eighth dan senseis of the Shorin-ryu was demonstrating some things to me, and he had this kind like a face of like a kindly older woman. But you don't mess with this guy. He was really fast. He just really knew his moves. He was in his late 60s. But he said, just kind of casually says, "Yes, we study the sutras of karate." And I said, "Well, I didn't know there was such a like book of sutras or something. I'd like to read it." And he says, "No, there's no book. It's the kata. It's the moves. They can follow the principles." And I felt like I was having a Karate Kid moment. You know, it's like, I don't want to go back. You know, it's like, backs off. You know, teach me more, right?
Right.
But it was so much, there's so much of the discipline is a big part, the discipline and the posture. In fact, the word posture, this is really interesting. The roots of the word posture means a form with energy, but it also can mean energy. So it's an energetic or a beautiful form.
Yeah, and I think part of the point there is the way that you carry yourself, the way that you stand or the way that you are says something about the way that you're going to act. You know, I think our companies, when we're in a company, we're building a culture, we're training a team, the way that they act in the small times or when there's not a big ethical dilemma or it's not really defined by the code of ethics, but it's kind of the right thing to do, that's going to define how they act. You know, that posture of doing it right or sticking to the code, even if it's not defined in one of your 65 behavioral rules, sticking to that posture is the energy that's going to flow into a time when there is a conflict and maybe nobody's watching and you could do something bad, you know, you're part of a culture where, you know, it's you're going to make the right choice.
Yeah. Well, you know, the movies always emphasize the, because they want to show the drama, they'll show the revenge and the, and the fighting and that. But one of the other things, well, there are two parts of the, which is like one quarter of the Bushido code, compassion and respect. And and these are, I think, come from Confucian values, but the idea that a person who is stronger because of their samurai training would not use this to lord over people, but use this to protect the weaker ones, and would be willing to like to show sympathy according to circumstances. And you even have this today. If you are caught doing something and you refuse to apologize or show any sense of regret over your actions, your punishment is going to be a lot worse. They even have a word for it, the color of self reflection. They look at your face. Do you have any color of sort of that? Oh yeah, I didn't do the right thing. The feeling sorry.
Are you remorseful?
Genuinely. Yeah, remorseful or apologizing. And in fact, the word for I'm sorry literally means it isn't finished, which means I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it right. Sumimasen. It's not finished. And they even had a really interesting thing in the Edo period that a word for apology, but it had an adjective that goes with this. I don't know how to translate it well, but here's the situation. Somebody steps on your foot. Who apologizes?
You would assume that the person who steps on the foot apologizes.
Yeah, you would assume that. Well, in Japan, I'm not saying now, but traditionally, it would be the person whose foot got stepped on that would apologize because they put their foot in a position where it might be stepped on. I'm not necessarily recommending this because there's a car accident and you start apologizing, then they're going to take you to the cleaners, right?
So sure. but it's a posture, right? Well, it's a posture.
Yeah, it's an attitude that I'm sorry that something I did made this happen.
Yeah, it's a posture of responsibility, I think, above all else. You know, I imagine that's, you know, your description of the someone stepping on a foot, that's a description for the person who gets their foot stepped on of, well, don't just play the victim, kind of realize that you contributed to this. I don't think it would, you know, I don't think someone is meant to hear that and say, okay, well, I'm going to go step on everyone's foot and they're going to apologize to me.
Or sue them, you know, take them to court. you admitted it, right?
Yeah, right. He said he's sorry. But there's something there and there's something in, oh, sorry, go ahead.
As I said, usually the responses, they would, again, no, it was my fault, you know, so they both apologize and then that reduces the friction. That's what's supposed to happen. It's not supposed to be, okay, you admitted it, therefore you're guilty.
Right. I think that's where I'm excited to see companies move to. And I think that's where we as ethics experts can help lead the way is when something goes bad, it's not just, oh, well, let's fire this person and then the problem solved. We as a company, you know, we are the employees who maybe got discriminated against by this boss, or we are the leaders who allowed this to happen. And this is not, you know, this is kind of the opposite of a scapegoat mentality that says, okay, well, we fired the executive and now everything's fine. But we as a company, we as an ethics team should say, hey, this was an environment, right? This company and this culture had a posture that allowed that to happen. So let's get, you know, the worst actor out, but let's also say, hey, you know what? We're also sorry. And, you know, figure out how to do it without putting yourself into an unnecessary lawsuit. But we need to clean up our culture because it's not just the that single perpetrator, but the environment, the behavior, the values that we've let slip or, you know, even maybe encouraged allowed that to happen here. And we need to, you know, we as a company, this culture writ large needs to say that we're sorry in a way that, like you said, it's not finished. We're going to make it right.
Yeah. Oh, well, and you know, how much better would things be if everyone took some degree of responsibility? Says, well, we're sorry. It wasn't right, but we're going to make it right. And everybody, you know, takes some measure to work on improving a situation.
Yeah.
But you know, it used to be, and I don't know if this was just like the way things are or just the way things were presented, but it seems to me it used to be that right and wrong were a little bit more obvious, or maybe it was the way we were taught. I don't know if you remember Goofus and Gallant. I
mean, Yeah, they're great.
Back in elementary school, and I just pulled one up on the internet, and they always contrast the two behaviors that's just so obvious, especially with the body language you see. Huh. So Goofus bosses his friends. Gallant asks, "What do you want to do next?" It's just so obvious. And then Goofus takes the last apple. Gallant shares his orange.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you can illustrate a lot by those contrasts.
Yeah. And I don't know, somebody's having fun with this, but there's a lot of these, they use the same original cartoons and they add contemporary captions. This was one, it's exact same cartoon about the boss thing, the friends versus what do you want to do next. But it says, Goofus treats new ideas as false until somebody provides incontrovertible evidence that they are true. Gallant does cost benefit analysis and reasons under uncertainty. You know, it's like, what are they talking about?
Yeah. Let's define that even deeper, huh?
It shouldn't be that hard, you know.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that's an interesting point, Will. It shouldn't be that hard. I think some things that make sense about, but also there's, you know, I think that there's some things about the samurai code of ethics and the way that samurai behaved that they treated it like maybe it was hard, or they had to put a lot of effort into making sure that this worked. It's not enough to just teach all the children when they're 4 years old, hey, here's the code, here are the seven things, and here's what you should do. You know, I think that they did a lot to reinforce that. And there's a tipping point that you get to when your culture embodies that, where the culture reinforces itself. But I think that they, you know, I think that you've talked about this before, maybe in your speeches or your writing, about how there was a very intentional approach to building these ethics into the culture of the people who are part of it, grafting people onto that vine, helping them understand this is the way that it should go. And it was maybe more of a teaching and cultural way to implement it than a policy and policing. Can you talk to us about that? And you know, kind of what can company leaders today learn from that? Because I think it's different from that 1990s style of compliance and legal defensibility and things like that. It seems to be a much more proactive and culture focused piece.
Well, you know, one aspect of samurai culture that I find very interesting is the so many symbols everywhere. Symbols reminding you of meanings. Like, for example, the crest of the family. One of my favorite crests is three sails to the wind and waves. And so it's just like a kind of a reminder of that we will go against adversity and we will be unified. Or they have the famous story of the three arrows, where the father had three sons who were always bickering, and he gave each one an arrow, and they were easily able to break it. And then he gave them a pack of three arrows, and they couldn't break it. And so you should be unified. So their family.
I got that lesson as a kid with my brother, and we always stayed stronger after that.
It's a really interesting way to teach, because it's not relying on rules or ethics. It's relying on discovery and, can I say, visual symbolism, or even, you know, in some martial arts, like in Aikido and in Iaido or Kendo, they will wear a hakama. It's kind of a split skirt, split skirt, and it has pleats. And a lot of people don't realize it, but the number of pleats is actually very significant. There are five on the front and two in the back. And the five front pleats represent courage, benevolence, justice, courtesy, and sincerity. And the two pleats on the back represent loyalty and honor. So, I mean, it was just that. I mean, a lot of people don't know that. They just put on their hakama. But it would have definitely been something that would have been taught to samurai. They would know the meaning of or the symbolism, even on this sword, for example. I don't know if you can see the menuki, which is the sword ornament underneath the cord that is wrapped around the handle.
Is that a firefly?
Yeah, exactly. It's a dragonfly. Not a firefly.
Dragonfly. That's right.
It's partly hidden by the okay. But anyway, it's that actually has a meaning. It was considered to be the victory insect, because it always moves forward, and it It can appear to be still, but it's actually filled with energy. It can move quickly, hovering. So like just symbolism everywhere. Everywhere you look in the armor, they would tie cords that had the dragonfly symbol to them that would be hanging from the helmet. And so the samurai wives would decorate the helmets with these things, the idea that they would come back safely. And so, you know, you could say it's kind of superstitious in a way, but there's just symbolism and visual reminders everywhere about, you know, the codes that they were living by.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, there may be something that our modern day culture would call symbolism, or I mean, call superstition around some of that. But there's a lot of, I think, strength and cultural implications to building some of that symbolism. And, you know, that reminder, as you see that says, okay, you know, that's how I should act, you know, and maybe it gets you to think, okay, maybe, you know, that call or that deal I'm negotiating, you know, I should bring more of our kind of ethics into it. And in a lot of ways, I think that we can learn from the samurai and that in the fact that they inserted or they reminded meaning in so many of the things around them that in some ways, there are forces kind of moving people in different directions from suppliers, from, you know, things they see in the culture, from competition, from other internal teams. And we as leaders need to help reinforce our culture. And it can be through that symbolism, and it can be through, you know, clarifying what, you know, how these ethics and how, what the principle and spirit of our values are and how they can be applied. Because if we think that just writing out 65 rules or giving somebody a 25-page policy book is going to affect their behavior, then, you know, we're going to be sadly mistaken. And I think we've seen over the past kind of 20 years plus how that, you know, really doesn't suffice. And we need to move into a phase where we don't just have policies and we don't just enforce things when we find out about them, but we're proactive and we're active in building an effective culture that builds the ethic and the integrity that we really care about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I suppose you could consider logos in a way, although companies are already kind of stuck with their logo. But if the logo or some of the visual elements that are associated with a project could build in a couple of reminders like that. I mean, and you could take hints from the family crests of Japan. Mm. They're just some beautiful ones. They're beautifully designed, even though they're quite ancient. They have a very modern feeling and.
And they're very thoughtful. Used as,
so that's one way. And I think another way that's probably easier to implement would be through stories. That the wisdom stories, the stories that illustrate, you know, how a certain behavior leads to a preferred result.
Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, there can be a lot of. There's a lot to leverage in that, right? There's a lot to leverage that, you know, I think the samurai were pragmatic in a sense to realize that the way that you reinforce culture needs to resonate with a human in their heart so that they make that decision in the right way. It's not just training somebody on these things, but having the process, having that kind of mental or values piece infused into the physical and the martial arts training. Having this symbolism kind of buttress that, having, you know, the logos or the stories, you have to get people to be part of this culture, not just tell some robots, you know, what the rule is.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up here, Will, I'd love to hear if you have, you know, either a challenge or some advice to our audience as, you know, this has been a really interesting perspective on how this, you know, this ancient code of ethics can apply to us as business leaders and as ethics experts. I'd be interested if, you know, you have something, any kind of parting advice or a challenge to our audience who are often, you know, who often want to see things move in this direction, want to be part of a company and be leading a company in the direction of more integrity, more of a values-based, you know, ethos and ethic. You know, what can you leave us with as we wrap up here, Will?
Okay, well, that's a great question. Actually, there's a book that I'd like to recommend. It's called Target. And then the subtitle is Business Wisdom from the Ancient Japanese Martial Art of Kudo. Kudo is Japanese archery. And it's written by Jerome Shishon, who's a friend of mine, and he also happens to be the director of Godiva Chocolates for Japan and all of Asia Pacific. The reason he's a fifth dan master in Kudo as well. So he applied the principles of samurai ethics as he learned from Kudo in his business, and in 5 years he doubled their sales, and in 7 years he tripled them. And this what this book is about. And so it's a really good example of how you can take some ancient wisdom. In this case, it happens to come from samurai culture, and you apply it. For example, one of the, just to give you a quick example, that hitting the target is obviously the goal, but if that is your only goal, you're gonna, in Kudo, you don't pass the test. It's a lot about the process. It's how you stand, it's how you breathe, how you move, and the natural result of that. So right shooting results in right hitting. And so what they did in the business is they focused more on the packaging and the customer satisfaction and the process. Of course, you know, the quarterly goals and the numerical targets, somebody's going to look at that, but that became a natural result of the proper behavior towards the product and packaging and the customers, as opposed to the, we got to get those numbers regardless of the means.
That's great. I love that. That's a great way to wrap up, Will. It's been awesome chatting with you today. And I think that that's an awesome challenge to our team. And, you know, it's something that we talk, you know, or to our audience, we talk about kind of moving from this compliance 2.0 that was just focused on efficiency to a compliance 3.0 that's focused on effectiveness and transforming culture. And I think that ties in, you know, like I hear notes of that when you say, what was it? Right shooting results in right aim. What was it?
Right shooting results in. Right shooting always results in a hit. That's be the way to say it.
Right shooting always results in a hit. So, I'd love to wrap up on that point, and you know, just encourage everyone in the audience that the way that we go about our work, the way that we build our ethics program, it's not about just getting the policy executed and getting the training rolled out and doing this, but the way that we do it is going to make all the difference. And I think that the companies and the leaders and the ethics experts who realize that doing ethics and integrity correctly involves the process that you do it with and the thoughtfulness with which you apply it, not just whether you have a, you know, a policy that a lawyer signed off on. And Will, you've given us a lot of context here. As a Renaissance samurai, you've given us a lot of context about how this ancient code of ethics, this samurai culture can inform us, can inspire us, and can help us be more effective as ethics experts. And we appreciate you joining us today, Will.
Thank you so much. Well, I think if you model it yourself and you think deeply about it, it shouldn't be that difficult. It should be self-evident. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Let's just see it together, you know?
Yeah, and I think it takes that effort up front for us to be conscious that once we build a culture of ethics, then it doesn't have to be as hard because it reinforces itself, because everyone's clear on it, because everyone has experience choosing the right thing over the wrong thing. But if you're not there yet, you know, if you have to build that culture, then, you know, I think it takes some intentionality and probably more than you think up front to build that as a self-reinforcing dynamic within your culture. But, you know, I think we can all agree that that it's worth it and that getting it right can make all the difference in the lives of people and the success of your business.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a pleasure, Gio, and love to continue the conversation at some time. It's a really interesting topic and it's very important for our world today.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for joining us, Will. So people can find you at samurai-walk.com, correct?
Yeah, samurai-walk.com.
Yeah.
That would be the best place to go.
And where else should people keep an eye out for you? Or is there anything else you want to leave us with as we wrap up?
on the top page, I have links to other podcasts that I've done, as well as YouTube channel, Instagram account, you know, Facebook, all that. So it's all on the front page. So www.samurai, SAMURAI-WALK.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I will try to say gohomon arigato gozaimasu.
Gozaimasu arigato. Okay. Very good. Thanks, Gio.
All right. Thank you, Will.